Part 3. Nathaniel, Chapter 22. Nathaniel's plane was due to leave the Box Hill Aerodrome at 6:30 sharp. His official car would arrive at the ministry an hour earlier, at 5:30. This meant that he had approximately half a day to prepare himself for the most important assignment of his brief career in government, his trip to Prague. His first task was to deal with his servant and proposed travelling companion. On his return to Whitehall, he found a free summoning chamber, and, with a clap of the hands, summoned Bartimaeus once more. When it materialized, it had rid itself of its panther guise, and was in one of its favoured forms, a young, dark-skinned boy. Nathaniel noted that the boy was not wearing its usual Egyptian-style skirt. Instead, it was lavishly dolled up in an old-fashioned tweed travelling suit, with spats, gaiters, and incongruously a leather flying helmet complete with goggles, loose upon its head. Nathaniel scowled. "And you can lose those for starters. You're not flying." The boy looked wounded. "Why not?" "Because I'm travelling incognito, and that means no demons waltzing through customs."
"What? Do they put us in quarantine now?"
"Czech magicians will be scanning all incoming flights for magic, and they'll subject a British plane to the finest scrutiny of all. No artifact, book of magic, or idiot demon will get through. I shall have to be a commoner for the duration of my flight. You I'll have to summon once I've arrived."
The boy raised its goggles, the better to look sceptical. "I thought the British Empire ruled the roost in Europe," it said. "You broke Prague years ago. How come they're telling you what to do?"
"They're not. We control the balance of power in Europe still, but officially we have a truce with the Czechs now. For the moment, we're guaranteeing no magical incursions into Prague. That's why this trip has to be done subtly."
"Speaking of subtle," the boy gave a broad wink,
"I did pretty well earlier, eh?"
Nathaniel pursed his lips.
"Meaning what?"
"Well, I was on my best behavior this morning. Didn't you notice? I could have given your masters plenty of lip, but I restrained myself to help you out."
"Really? I thought you were your normal, irritating self."
"Are you kidding? I was so oily my feet practically slipped from under me. I can still taste that false humility on my tongue. But that's better than being popped into one of dear Jessica's mournful orbs again." The boy shuddered. "My sucking up only lasted a few minutes, though. It must be horrible kowtowing to them perpetually, as you do, and knowing that you could stop that game at any time you wished and go your own way, except that you haven't got the bottle to do it."
"You can stop right there. I'm not interested in your opinion."
Nathaniel was having none of this. Demons often threw half-truths at magicians to disorientate them. It was best to close your ears to their wiles.
"Besides," he added, "Duval, for one, is not my master. I despise him."
"And Whitwell's different, is she? I didn't notice any great love between you."
"Enough. I must pack, and I have to visit the Foreign Office before I go."
Nathaniel looked at his watch.
"I shall require you again in 12 hours' time at my hotel in Prague. Until I summon you again, I bind you into a nexus here. Remain silent and invisible in this circle, beyond the knowledge or senses of all sentient things, until I send for you."
The boy shrugged. "If I must."
"You must."
The figure in the pentacle shimmered and faded slowly, like the memory of a dream. When it was entirely gone, Nathaniel worked a couple of backup charms to prevent anyone unknowingly releasing the jinni, if they chose to use the circle, and left hurriedly. He had a busy few hours ahead of him. Before departing for his home to pack, Nathaniel called in at the Foreign Office, a building not dissimilar to the British Museum in size, bulk, and brooding grey power. Here, much of the day-to-day running of the Empire took place. Magicians relaying advice and instructions by means of telephone and messenger to their counterparts in smaller offices across the world. As he climbed the steps to the revolving door, Nathaniel looked up at the roof. Even on the three planes that he was able to observe, the sky above the building was thick with the hurrying of insubstantial forms. Fleet couriers carrying orders in magically coded envelopes, larger demons acting as their escorts. As always, the sheer scale of the great empire, which could be sensed only in sights such as this, left him awestruck and a little preoccupied. In consequence, he had some trouble with the revolving entrance door, In pushing vigorously the wrong way, he unfortunately sent an elderly, grey-haired lady sprawling backwards into the foyer on the other side, her armload of papers streaming out across the marbled floor. After negotiating the door successfully, Nathaniel hurried forward, and with a dozen flustered apologies, helped his victim to her feet, before beginning the task of scooping up the papers. As he did so, accompanied by a continuous volley of reedy complaints from the old woman, he saw a familiar, slim form emerge from a door on the opposite side of the foyer, and make her way across. Jane Farrar, Duval's apprentice, as elegant and glisteningly dark-haired as ever. Nathaniel's face went scarlet. He speeded up frantically, but there were many papers to gather, and the foyer was not large. Long before he had finished, and while the old lady was still spiritedly telling Nathaniel what she thought of him, Miss Farrar had arrived on the scene. He glimpsed her shoes out of the corner of one eye. She had halted and was watching. He could well imagine her air of detached amusement. With a deep breath, he stood and thrust the papers into the old woman's hands.
"There. Once again, I'm sorry."
"I should think so, too. Of all the careless, arrogant, most pestilential little—"
"Yes. Let me help you through that door."
With a firm hand he spun her round, and with a guiding shove between her shoulder blades, set her speedily on her way. Brushing himself down, he turned and blinked, as if in vast surprise.
"Miss Farrar, what a pleasure this is!"
She smiled a lazy, secret smile.
"Mr. Mandrake, you seem a little out of breath."
"Am I?" "Well, I am rather urgently engaged this afternoon, and then that poor old woman's legs gave way, so I tried to help."
Her cool eyes appraised him.
"Well, I'd better be getting along."
He half moved to one side, but Jane Farrar suddenly stepped a little closer.
"I know you're busy, John," she said, "but I would love to pick your brains about something, if I might be so bold."
She twizzled a strand of long black hair idly with a finger.
"What luck for me! I'm so glad we met by chance. I hear on the grapevine that you managed to summon a fourth-level jinni recently. Is that really true?"
She looked at him with wide, dark eyes, brimming with admiration. Nathaniel took a slight step back. He felt perhaps a little hot, certainly a little flattered, but still very unwilling to discuss matters as private as his choice of demon. It was unfortunate that the incident at the British Museum had been so public. Speculation would be rife about his servant now, but it was never wise to be unguarded. Safe, secret, secure. He gave a harried smile.
"It is true. You were not misinformed. It's nothing too difficult, I assure you. Now, if you don't mind—"
Jane Farrar gave a little sigh, and adjusted a strip of hair, becomingly, behind one ear.
"You are clever," she said. "You know, I've tried to do exactly that, to raise a demon of the fourth level, but I must be getting muddled somehow, because I just can't do it. I can't think what the problem is. Couldn't you come along with me now and run me through the incantations? I've got a summoning circle all of my own. It's in my apartment, not far from here. It's very private. We wouldn't be disturbed."
She tilted her head slightly to one side and smiled. Her teeth were very white. Nathaniel was conscious of a bead of sweat trickling in an ungainly fashion down the side of his forehead. He contrived to smooth his hair back and brush the drip away in what he hoped was a casual motion. He felt distinctly odd, languorous, yet fired up and energetic all at once. After all, it would be an easy thing to help Miss Farrar. Summoning a jinni was pretty straightforward when you've done it a few times. It was no big deal. He suddenly realized he rather desired her gratitude. She touched his arm gently with slender fingers.
"What do you say, John?"
He opened and shut his mouth, frowning. Something was holding him back. Something about time or lack of it. What was it? He'd come to the ministry to—
To do what, exactly? It was so hard to recall.
She gave a little pout.
"Are you worried about your master? She'll never find out. And I won't tell mine. I know we're not supposed to—"
"It's not that," he said. "It's just—"
"Well, then—"
"No, I've got something to do today. Something important." He tried to tear his eyes away from hers. He couldn't concentrate, that was the problem, and his heart was beating far too noisily for his memory to make itself heard. She was wearing a delightful fragrance, too, not your normal rowan tree rub-on, but a perfume much more oriental and flowery. It was very nice, but a bit overpowering. The scent of her proximity muddled him.
"What is that something?" she asked. "Maybe I can help you with it."
"I'm going somewhere. To Prague." She pressed a little closer.
"Are you? What for?"
"To investigate—" He blinked, shook his head. Something was wrong.
"Tell you what," she said. "We could sit together and have a nice talk. You could tell me everything you're planning."
"I suppose.
I've got a lovely long couch."
"Have you?
We can cozy up together and drink iced sherbet, and you can tell me all about this demon you summon, this Bartimaeus. I'd be so impressed."
As she spoke the name, a little warning note sounded in his mind, cutting through his luxurious befuddlement. Where had she learned Bartimaeus's name? It could only be from Duval, her master, who had himself learned it that very morning in the summoning chamber. And Duval was no friend of his. He would want to stymie anything Nathaniel was doing, even his trip to Prague. He stared at Jane Farrar with growing suspicion. Realization came flooding back, and for the first time he noticed his sensor web emitting a dull pulse in his ear, warning him of the presence of a subtle magic on his person. A charm, or perhaps a glamour. Even as he thought this, the luster of her hair seemed to fade a little, the sparkle in her eyes flickered and dimmed.
"I'm sorry, Miss Farrar," he said huskily. "Your invitation is very kind, but I must decline. Please give my regards to your master."
She regarded him silently, the look of doe-eyed admiration replaced fleetingly by one of bottomless contempt. A moment later the familiar, measured coolness had returned to Jane Farrar's face. She smiled.
"He will be pleased to receive them."
Nathaniel gave a short bow and left her. When he glanced back from the other side of the foyer, she had already gone. He was still a little disorientated by this encounter 5 minutes later, when he emerged from a lift on the third floor of the ministry, crossed a broad, echoing corridor, and arrived at the second secretary's door. He adjusted his cuffs, composed himself for a moment, knocked, and entered. It was a high-ceilinged room of oak-panelled walls. Light streamed in from elegantly tapering windows overlooking the busy traffic of Whitehall. The room was dominated by 3 great wooden tables, their upper surfaces inlaid with stretches of stippled green leather. Upon these were a dozen unfurled maps of varying size, some of pristine paper, others of ancient, cracking vellum, all pinned carefully onto the leather tabletops. A small, bald man, the second secretary of the Foreign Office, was stooped over one such map, tracing some detail with his finger. He glanced up and nodded affably.
"Mandrake, good. Jessica said you'd be calling. Come in. I've got the Prague maps ready for you."
Nathaniel crossed over to stand beside the secretary, whose diminutive frame barely reached the level of his shoulder. The man's skin was yellow-brown, the colour of a sun-stained parchment, and had a dry and dusty quality. He stabbed a finger down upon the map.
"Now, that's Prague. A fairly recent map, as you can see. It shows the trenches left by our troops in the Great War. You're familiar with the city in principle, I take it?"
"Yes, sir." Nathaniel's efficient mind smoothly accessed the relevant information. "The castle district is on the west bank of the Vltava, the old town on the east. The old magical quarter used to be near the castle, didn't it, sir?"
"That's right." The finger shifted. "Over here, hugging the hill. Golden Lane was where most of the Emperor's magicians and alchemists were based, until Gladstone's lads marched in, of course. Nowadays, what magicians the Czechs do have are barracked out of the town centre in the suburbs, so there's little, if anything, going on near the castle. It's all run down there, I believe. The other old magical centre," the finger moved east across the river, "is the ghetto, here. That was where Lo created the first golems, back in Rudolf's day. Others in that area continued the practice up until the last century, so I imagine it's there, if anywhere, that the appropriate law will have been guarded." He glanced up at Nathaniel.
You realize this is a fool's errand, don't you, Mandrake? If they've had the ability to create golems all this time, why haven't they been doing so? Heaven knows we've defeated them in battle often enough. No, I can't see it myself.
I'm only acting on information received, sir, Nathaniel said respectfully. Prague seems the appropriate place to begin.
His neutral tone and posture concealed the fact that he agreed wholeheartedly with everything the secretary had said.
Well, you know best.
The second secretary's voice made it clear he thought Nathaniel didn't.
Now, see this packet? That contains your fake passport for the trip. You'll be travelling as Derek Smithers, a young apprentice working for Watts Wine Company of Marylebone. Your pack contains documents confirming that, should Czech customs get fussy.
Derek Smithers, sir?
Nathaniel did not look too enthused.
Yes, only name we could get. Poor lad died of dropsy last month, at about your age. We've since appropriated his identity for government service. Now, you're officially going to Prague with a view to importing some of their excellent beer. I've put a list of brewers in your packet for you to memorize on the flight.
Yes, sir.
Right. Above all, you've got to be low-key on this mission, Mandrake. Don't draw attention to yourself in any way. If you have to use magic, do it quietly, and do it quickly. I hear you might be using a demon. If so, keep it under control.
Of course, sir.
The Czechs are not to know that you're a magician. Part of our current treaty with them is that we promise not to conduct any magical activities on their territories, and vice versa.
Nathaniel frowned.
But, sir, I heard that Czech infiltrators have been active in Britain recently. Surely they're breaking the treaty. The secretary flashed an irritated side glance at Nathaniel and tapped his fingers on the map.
That is so. They are quite untrustworthy. Who knows? They may even be behind this golem incident of yours, too.
In that case...
I know what you're about to say, Mandrake. Of course, there's nothing we'd like better than to march our armies into Wenceslas Square tomorrow and show the Czechs what's what. But we can't do that right now.
Why not, sir?
Because of the American rebels. We're unfortunately a trifle stretched just at this moment. Won't last long. We'll mop up the Yankees and then turn our attention back to Europe. But just at this point, we don't want anything causing ructions. Got that?
Of course, sir.
Besides, we're breaking the truce in a dozen ways as well. That's diplomacy for you. In truth, the Czechs have been getting above themselves for the last 10 years. Mr. Devereux's campaigns in Italy and Central Europe were inconclusive, and the Prague Council have begun to probe our empire for weaknesses. They're nipping at us the way a flea does a dog. Never mind. All will come right in time.
The second secretary wore an expression in which hardness and complacency were equally mingled. He turned his attention to the map again.
"Now then, Mandrake," he said briskly, "you'll be wanting a contact in Prague, I suppose. Someone to help you get your bearings?"
Nathaniel nodded.
"Do you have someone there, sir?"
"We do. One of our top agents. His name is Harlequin."
Harlequin? In his mind's eye, Nathaniel saw a slender, masked figure, stealing with a dancing step among the shadows, carrying an air of carnival and menace in its wake.
"Indeed. That is his agent's title. His real name I cannot tell you. Possibly it is unknown even to himself. If you're visualizing a slender, masked gentleman, colourfully costumed and spry of foot, then think again. Our Harlequin is a plump, elderly man of funereal temperament. Also, he is given to wearing black."
The secretary made a face of refined distaste.
"Prague does that to you, if you stay there too long. It is a melancholy city. Several of our agents have been driven to suicide over the years. Harlequin seems sound enough so far, but he is a trifle morbid in his sensibilities."
Nathaniel swept his hair out of his eyes.
"I'm sure I can handle that, sir. How will I meet him?"
"At midnight this evening. Leave your hotel and make your way to the cemetery in the ghetto. That is here, by the way, Mandrake. See? Just along from the old town square. You are to wear a soft cap with a blood-red feather in it and stroll among the tombstones. Harlequin will find you. You will recognize him by the distinctive candle that he carries."
"A distinctive candle?"
"That's right."
"What, is it particularly long or wonky or what?"
"He did not furnish me with that information."
Nathaniel made a face.
"Pardon me, but it all seems a bit melodramatic, doesn't it, sir? All these cemeteries and candles and blood-red feathers. Couldn't he just give me a ring in my hotel room when I've had a shower and meet me in a cafe downstairs?"
The secretary smiled bleakly. He passed the packet across to Nathaniel and made his way behind the furthest table to a plush leather chair, in which he sat with a small sigh. He swiveled it to face the windows, where watery clouds could be seen hanging low over London. It was raining far off to the west. smudged marks in the sky angled down into unseen folds of the city. The secretary gazed out for a time without speaking. "Behold the modern city," he said at last, "built to the finest modern templates. Look at the proud buildings of Whitehall, none of them more than 150 years old. Of course there are tatty, unreconstructed areas still. That is inevitable, with so many commoners about. But the heart of London, where we work and live, is entirely forward-looking. A city of the future, a city worthy of a great empire. Your Miss Whitwell's apartment, Mandrake, a fine building. It exemplifies the modern trend. There should be many more like that. Mr. Devereux plans to bulldoze much of Covent Garden next year, rebuild all those little timber-framed houses as glorious visions of concrete and glass." The chair swiveled back towards the room. He gestured at the maps. "Prague, now, that's different, Mandrake. By all accounts, it is a particularly gloomy sort of spot, far too nostalgic for the glories of its vanished past. Bit of a morbid fixation on things that are dead and gone. The magicians, the alchemists, the great Czech Empire. Well, any doctor could tell you, that's an unhealthy sort of outlook. If Prague was a human, we'd lock her in a sanatorium. Now, I dare say we could shake Prague out of her daydreams if we chose, Mandrake, but we don't choose. No. Far better to have her mind muddled and mysterious, rather than clear-cut and far-sighted like London's. And people such as Harlequin, who keep an eye on things there for us, have to think in the same way as the Czechs do, or they wouldn't be any good to us, would they? Harlequin is a better spy than most, Mandrake, hence his colourful instructions. I suggest you follow them to the letter."
"Yes, sir. I'll certainly do my best."